This is part five of our ongoing interview with Gerd Stern, whom I'm calling a poet of communications, and this is August 17, 2008. We are going to pick up around 1967. Gerd has been to the LSD conference, and what was interesting, looking through the Bancroft College history, you, Gerd Usko, projected weather balloons, huge 18-foot balloons.
No, 18-foot, 6 to 8 feet.
Oh, it says they're huge 18-foot balloons. That's
there are mistakes here and there and everywhere, right?
Right.
Those balloons were anything from 4 to 6 to 8 feet, but they sure weren't any more than that. And yes, we use them in a number of occasions, both the way we use them at the conference and at, like, where was that? Like, university in the Midwest.
The LSD conference, you mean, or another conference?
No, I mean, we've used it at a number of places. What we did then is we blew them up and we tossed them into the audience, and then when the audience tossed them up, we projected on them what was handheld carousels.
Wow.
Now, that's only one modality that we use those. The other one is a piece which was first at the ICA in Boston and then more recently at the Whitney and in Vienna at the X-Screen, Moomock. Anyway, it's like four of those balloons in a cluster hung from a ceiling rotating with a 1 RPM motor and with two film projections and two slide projections from each from one corner. And the thing is conceived because, you know, it's kind of an exercise in focus. Now, you have four image planes because the balloons are translucent, right? So you get two concave and two convex images. But the focus, since you've got this one RPM rotation, is always moving. Now, according to Harry Parch, I think I told you this once, I'm not sure, focus was the narrow path where three roads met and Oedipus met and killed his father.
Focus was the word, you're saying?
Focus was the name of that pass.
Where, you know, say that again, Oedipus did what?
Where three roads met and Oedipus met and killed his father.
Ah, not knowing who he was, right?
That's right, not knowing who he was.
And that's focusing.
Focus. That's where the word came from, according to Harry Parch. But probably in Greek, you know, it was spelled a little different, right?
Mm. Now, does that relate to the...
And it's definitely focus. It's not fuck us.
No, does that relate to the thought that you guys had, or is this just a side thought?
It's a side thought. It's a tangent. It ain't the tan lady.
We're in for a rocky ride today, we can tell. Gerd's all
Funned
up.
Not my word.
Once upon a time.
Okay. Oh, God, that's Little Red Riding Hood.
Now, talk about three roads converging. This would be in 66 or 67. This LSD conference. Is this the time when Steve...
No. 56?
No, 66, 67 period.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And maybe the Midwest Conference would be, University of Wisconsin in Madison?
No. It was, one of those hip avant-garde colleges. There were two of them, right? In Ohio.
Yeah, the one where Robert Anton Wilson taught, I think. think I heard about that.
I just can't think of names easily.
Well, the
anyway,
hip people will know what you're referring to.
Yeah, so we, so the balloons. Now, at the ICA, listen to this. The film, one film and one slide was of a nude couple in the Shiva Shakti position, and the other were oscilloscope waves in kind of bluish, form. Now, we put it in the ICA, and about 10 days later, I read in a review that somebody sent me from the Christian Science Monitor, this place, the show was in Boston, that the nicest piece, I mean, this was a show of projected images with people like Stan Vanderbeek and Les Levine and us, and I read that the nicest piece in the show was these weather balloons with abstract color images on them. And I'm thinking to myself, what's going on? So I get in the car. Now we're in Rockland County, so it's a few hours to go to Boston, right? And the next morning, I'm at the gallery and I see our piece, and right on, it's got abstract color images, not nude Shiva Shakti position. So I go to see the director, a young lady, and she says to me, oh, Garrett, I should have let you know. I said, what? She said, you know, my last show was Keenholz, and it was that car with the people fucking in it.
Yeah.
And my board of directors told me if there was any more pornography or obscenity or nudity, I wouldn't have a job. So when you opened, I didn't really quite realize, you know, there were so many people and so much stuff, that those were nude figures. So I didn't want to lose my job, so I got a ladder, and I went up to the projectors, and I defocused the lenses.
Defocused
the lenses, right? So I, you know, I thought about it, and I thought, okay, I don't want this lady to lose her job. Hey, abstract images, you know. But when we showed it at the Vienna, the Whitney, it was the nudes. Anyway,
that's a few years ago. That's recently. You're talking 40 years.
The Newmark was, I think, 5 years ago, and the Whitney was about 4 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Just because it wasn't the recent Whitney show,
yeah,
which had one of the tabernacle paintings, but not the weather balloons.
Right. I went to both. Yeah.
Those aren't really considered psychedelic art, I don't think.
Okay. At the LSD conference, when you have these balloons, how long does that go on? Does it go on during the whole conference or just a half hour?
No, wait a minute. You don't get it. The LSD conference was basically an academic conference. And I have a photograph, and I actually have two cassette tapes of Richard Alpert going on and on.
Right.
This is before he became Ron Klaus.
Yes.
But the conference was for a number of days. We did what you might call the show for the conference, which was called We Are All One.
The conference or your show?
The show the middle of the conference. One late afternoon, I believe, or early evening. I have the program.
Yeah.
Yeah, USCO does We Are All One, but I was also on a panel, which had nothing to do with the show. You know, there were lots of people, you know, Timothy Leary.
Was Walter Bowert there, or did I ask you that last time?
Yeah, you asked me, and I don't really know.
Okay.
He certainly could have been.
Because he testified at Congress or in Congress around that time.
Yeah.
You know, supporting LSD.
Well,
Anyway, so the performance was separate from the panels. It wasn't in the middle.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it had nothing to do with the panels. It was an event.
Okay.
It probably lasted an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah, we're going to go into a little bit about Rabbi Schachter. And I think I Googled him last night, and up came a picture of him. And it's a recent picture. I think Alpert, Richard Ramdas, lives here on Maui, you know, near me. And he's doing a lecture, I think it's this weekend. And I think it was the poster for this lecture was a picture of him and Rabbi Zalman Schachter together.
It's certainly possible.
Right. And, you know, Zalman is someone who you, you know, hugely respect. You don't really respect Baba Ramdas. But the two of them
I
are friends.
I just feel very sorry for him.
Right, as a result of his stroke and all that, yeah. So that was just curious. It came up last night.
No, but Zalman and I go back to the period at the church because I don't know if I told you the story. I mean, through Ralph Metzner. Didn't I tell you about that when Ralph called me and he said, "This is Rabbi you've got to meet"?
Do you recall that, Scott? I recall it because I just read it in the Bancroft College history yesterday, so it's fresh in my mind. But I don't... Okay, here's the context that brings it out. Your interest in, I've got here, Mathers. What's his name? You know, the great occultist.
McGregor Mathers.
Yeah, McGregor Mathers and Yeats. That leads into Jung and then Robert Graves. Around Grace, that was the woman you were going to do the history
Grace
of...
Grace Clements.
That was the history of symbolism or something that you were going to do with her?
Symbology, yes.
Yeah, symbology. And you have the word in the interview, the whole thing was vermischt, V-E-R-M-I-S-C-H-T. Does that mean synchronistic?
No, that means mixed up.
Okay, mixed up. But...
Yeah, vermischt is mixed.
Okay, so... With your interest in Yeats, Mathers, Jung, Graves, the esoterica and the occult world was all background that made you ripe to be impressed with meeting a Jewish scholar of the Kabbalah, which is Rabbi Zalman. Maybe you might want to go a little bit into Yeats, Mathers, and Graves and Jung, how you looked at them, how that relates to Graves' work, and then that leads into the great meeting with Schachter, Rabbi Schachter.
Well, I mean... I had studied some Kabbalah earlier when I was in New York, especially the central kind of, for me, the central text of that movement called the Sefer Yetzirah.
Yes.
I was... Meeting Zalman was, definitely a peak experience. In fact, he and I had a very funny scene in Boston with Abe Maslow, you know, who wrote The Peak Experience.
Abraham Maslow, yeah, a major, the founder of the human potential psychology movement.
Well, I mean, he came to see Zalman. He had requested a meeting with Zalman, and I was there. We happen to be in a good state of mind, if you'll get the impression that he came in and he said, I understand, Rabbi Schachter, that you're a very knowledgeable person in Judaism. Here's why I came to see you. You know, I was like just a faculty member, nothing big was happening to me, and I one night, really, I was in bed with my wife, and I had this idea, and finally I woke her up, and I said, "Listen, I have this idea, and it'll either really make my reputation, or people will tell me I'm a complete maniac." And she said, "Go for it." And I went for Association. I wrote a bestseller, and it was all about the peak experience. Well, that's not why I came to see you, Rabbi Zalman. Schachter, I was born Jewish, but I don't have any Jewish education to speak of. Could you give me a reading list? And we had a really hard time keeping from laughing our heads off in his presence, but we had to be very serious, and Zalman said he would send him one, that he didn't have it right with him, but that he certainly had one and he could send it to him. After he left, we just laughed our heads off for a long time, a reading list he came for.
But you were stoned, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. The thing is you mean it's the literary approach that you're laughing at?
Well, how do you inoculate yourself with Judaism or with any kind of spiritual practice with a reading list?
After he did the peak experience.
Yeah, I mean, is that a little ironic?
It's ironic for post-literate and pre-literate people, but not for literate people. Literacy is the hidden ground of the whole thing. That's the peak experience, books.
The peak experience is iconic, not ironic.
Yeah, it's ironic. It's iconic for pre-literate and post-literate.
That's right.
For literate people, it's a grammatically correct prose story. And maybe categorizations. Aristotle's categories.
I hear you.
Okay. So but is there anything, did you look into Aleister Crowley when you were looking into Mathers?
Yeah, I think absolutely into Crowley. That was, it was out of Yeats.
Right, and are you studying Yeats in the 40s, in your late teens, early 20s, or is this the period in the early 60s when you're back in New York City, out in the country?
I started reading Yeats, I guess, in the 40s.
Right. And Mathers was early, right?
I don't know. It was probably when I was with Jane in New York.
Yeah, that would be the... that's the early...
50s.
That's the 50s.
Late 40s, early 50s.
Right.
No, 50s. 50s, not 40s.
Yeah, early 50s. Not before San Francisco, the many years of San Francisco. That stretched through the middle 50s.
Not before the first two times I was in San Francisco.
Right.
Okay, let's not get confused.
That's right. We're talking about the pre-Anne London phase of San Francisco. But when you met Harry Smith, in your encounters with him, did you discuss the occult and Crowley and those kind of things with him?
No.
He was into that.
I know, but later on we maybe got into it, but he was usually too drunk to really make any sense.
Okay. So,
not in San Francisco, but later.
In New York? I mean, back in New York. So, you had looked into the Kabbalah before you met Rabbi Zalman?
Yeah.
So then, did he give you extra esoteric, expert information on the Kabbalah, or just it made sense because you were stoned together?
No, that's not the secret of the relationship. The secret of the relationship is he brought me into an area of Jewish practice which I was not familiar with and which was entirely centered on spirituality rather than ritual, although the ritual was much looser and more lucid and more musical than any that I had experienced in my family Jewish trip.
The ritual that he brought in, is that what you're saying?
Yes, that he performed. Yes.
Right. Okay. Was he categorized? You talk about him as the main agency for New Age Judaism, but was there a more technical term? Was he Reformed Judaism or Orthodox? Well, he was married to an Orthodox. Maybe he was Orthodox, right? He came out of the Hasidic school.
He grew up Orthodox, and he was educated in Hasidus. He was educated by Lubavitch.
That would be in New York City?
That would be in New York, in Brooklyn.
Right. The guy
would also be probably before that in Belgium, maybe in Holland, where they came before they came to the United States.
But the Hasidic sect, or whatever it is,
yes,
is a result of Lubavitch. It did not exist before.
Lubavitch? No, not necessarily. There are probably at least a dozen Hasidic sects, and each one of them is based upon a historic, it may be many more generations, and it may be only a few, but a historic rabbi who came from a certain town. And Lubavitch came from Luba, you know, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All the other sects have names that come from geography. So
Hasidism came from Europe, and it was a couple hundred years old or something, or 100 years old, before the Brooklyn scene.
Yes, the father-in-law of the Lubavitch Rebbe, who was the most recent one, emigrated from Europe. He was a refugee. And the one who died recently, Rabbi Schneerson, was his son-in-law and had an engineering degree from the Sorbonne.
The one who lived almost to 100 years old?
Yeah.
Yeah. The one, he died only 5-7 years ago, and they thought he didn't die or that he was going to come back.
Well, no, there was a clique inside his congregation who wanted to anoint him as the Messiah. He never admitted that. He didn't want anything to do with it, is what most people think. However, he did something very unusual. He didn't name a successor, although he had some very important acolytes on. So that's not really done. But he did it. So there's no head of the movement, even though it's a hugely successful international movement.
Yeah. So Zalman Schachter comes out of that training.
Yes. He had a great difficulty with that movement because of his use of psychedelics and his other what they considered excesses of liberality or liberalism and
feminism.
And feminism, yes, absolutely. So that, but however he engaged with the Rebbe several years before the Rebbe passed, so that was a very important thing for him.
Now we can go into the story of how you met him. Your friend had experienced him and then invited him down to Millbrook, or had brought him to Millbrook and did ask him.
No, not my friend. One of the three Millbrook personalities, right? Ralph Metzner, who I knew, called me because we were across the river, right? And we used to spend a lot of time over there, and said that they had taken this rabbi on his first LSD trip, and he knew he wasn't really... Ralph is a refugee also, but he wasn't really into Judaism, although he's Jewish. He's still around. Anyway, that I would really be into this guy, and the next time he came down from Canada, he and I should get together, and that's what happened.
And so, at Millbrook?
No, we met at Rappaport's on 2nd Avenue, and I took him up to the church where we, by that time, it was after the Riverside, we had installed the tabernacle at the church. He really got off on it.
So that's 66, 67 period.
Yeah.
And then you and Judy have a child, and you name your son after him.
That's a few years later, yeah.
Do you want to tell him how his response to the name, the naming?
Well, I mean, you know, when I called him to tell him, he asked me what the name was, and I said, Tom. He said, but Garrett, you know, we don't name children after someone who's still alive. I said to him, he's a Tom. You've been married a number of times. You take LSD. You have a reputation as being pretty eccentric. And you're going to tell me I shouldn't name my son after you. Okay, I didn't name him after you. I named him after one of the founders of Hasidus, whose name was Zalman. And Zalman said to me, you know, Garrett, you're right, it's not a problem. And then we had done some work for the Loving Spoonful. And Zalman Yanofsky, he was one of the group, as you may remember.
Yeah, Zal Yanofsky.
Yeah, from Canada. He called me up. He says, Garrett, I hear you named your son after. I said, oh, Zolly, I'm sorry, you know, it wasn't really after you, it was after Rabbi Zalman Schachter. Zolly wasn't very happy about that, because somebody had told him that I'd name my son after him, right? So, about a year later, he calls me up. He says, Garrett, we just had a boy, and we're naming him after you. So it's not really after you. It's a friend of ours who runs a kosher deli in Chattanooga. Yeah. Right. Anyway.
So the posters you made for the Lovin' Spoonful, the covers
not
of
the
albums.
Not the posters. It was a concert album.
Concert album.
Psychedelic concert album.
I mentioned this before. You've heard of or know Wes Wilson, who sort of started the psychedelic poster thing in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, Wes Wilson. But, I mean, this was long before certain things. And afterwards, at Intermediate Systems, Kelly and Mouse worked for us and did things. But that was... The concert book was long before that.
Right, and Kelly Mouse, did Wes work with Kelly Mouse?
No, there were three big artists in that period. Kelly and Mouse Studios, that was two different people, one named Kelly and one named Mouse.
Yeah.
Kelly just died. And Wes.
And Wes.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, other cartoonists like Mad Comics or, you know...
Gilbert Shelton, the fabulous...
Whatever, we made that concert album. Steve Durkee had, you know, big inputs, and we collaged it heavily, and their manager was a mafia type, and when he saw it, he had all 10,000 copies. I believe.
Are these covers, psychedelic covers done by Steve, I guess, and all of you, or Steve?
By all of us, yes.
Were they before or same time as Wes Wilson and not aware of what Wes Wilson was doing?
They're nothing like that. They don't look like that.
Oh, okay.
There's no cross influence involved. They're more like photo stuff rather than photo stuff and geometric stuff, but not that modality which
Baroque.
There were lots of people because London had about 6 or 8 poster artists, and in the Summer of Love show there were over 100 posters from the Victoria and Albert Museum collection in London, and half of them were American, mostly San Franciscan, and the other half, well, some New York, the other half were English psychedelic. But it's all that same kind of, twisted image work.
Right, so now, is it in this period, the time of the Riverside Church meeting Rabbi...
Riverside Museum.
And meeting Rabbi Schechter and the LC conference, this period, is this when Steve and Barbara are trying to find the retreat from the chaotic church environment?
No, I don't think, not yet.
Not yet. So that's, we did talk about this in the last session where they're on their route to find a place, and that's when you stay at Richard Alpert's and Richard Baker is part of that circle.
No. You're getting confused. When they were living with Richard
Alpert
on the peninsula, they weren't looking for the place. That was the next trip.
Okay, so when and where did they find the place?
They found it in New Mexico, in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains.
Is that near Morris Strong's property that William Irwin Thompson bought for Lindisfarne?
No, that's where Richard Baker is now because Bill Thompson gave it to him. But that's in Colorado, in Crestone.
Oh, yes.
It's hours separate from New Mexico.
Is it near Taos?
Which one?
Your place, where Steve and Barbara found
it. Yeah, it's nearer to Taos and Santa Fe than it is to Colorado, Crestone.
Right, so did you spend time there?
Yes.
Any stories about that place? Is it still there?
It's still there after the fire, after many schisms. It's still there. I don't think there's anybody there who was there originally. I think Barbara goes back once in a while.
Did new owners come in, or who were the schisms?
The Lama Foundation.
Oh.
It's a foundation, and it has directors, and I've lost. Now, actually, there's a guy named Amy Cohen who has done a history of it, and he's interviewed me recently. In fact, he just sent me an email yesterday. He lives in Crestone, strangely enough, but he just spent a few months at Lama. So, one day Steve called me up. They were in New Mexico, and he said, "We found the place, and you won't believe, because it's owned by somebody named Israel." You've got to come out immediately, because Jonathan is willing to buy it for us, and we need you to come and look and see what you think. So I flew out, and we went, Hispanic, right? R-A-E-L. Not exactly Israel, but close enough for jazz, I guess. Anyway, it was a beautiful piece of land on top of the mountain. And, yes, it was bought.
What did the Lama Foundation do? What was their cultural
it
product?
It was a spiritual community. It was the western outpost of USCO originally. But very soon, USCO and Lama kind of became distant from each other in various ways, physically, obviously, and spiritually somewhat. There was a lot of Buddhism involved in Lama, and a lot of Ram Dass. And Zaman went there, and Sufi Sam had a big influence, one of the biggest.
Sufi Sam, I heard a lot about him from Walter Boward, a Boward publisher.
Yes, right.
And then, were you aware of Walter's? He had Omen Press, you know, with Peggy.
Yeah, I visited Walter and Peggy when he had Omen Press.
Yeah, the early 70s in Tucson.
Exactly.
So Walter would know about the Lama Foundation then, at that time.
Oh, absolutely. I knew Walter in New York.
Right, at East Village Other. So you're saying, okay, this brings up one of my notes. The split, there was schism or splitting at the church over whether to use drugs or not. And then the Mayor Baba influence. Did that filter into the Lama Foundation?
Because Steve and Barbara stopped using. Yes, Lama was not a drug community. I'm not saying nobody ever took
it. Right.
Basically, it was not a drug.
They were trying not to do drugs.
Right.
And you had Ram Dass. Is that one of the beginnings of Ram Dass's spiritual charisma after he came back from India? Is that where he began to lecture and that kind
no,
of stuff?
He lectured lots of places.
Right, but was that a
it was one of the places,
yeah. Yeah, one of his early support groups, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the book, Be Here Now,
which comes out about 72.
Came out of that.
Ah, they published it?
Yes.
Okay. So, again, Gerd, you're hooked into things that become memes or almost institutions later. The other thing, maybe you can get your timing on this, is you're on the New York State Council of Arts as a grant adjudicator. And
as a panelist.
Panelist, they called it, right. And you're judging who should get grants. Is that what you do on that panel?
Well, yeah, but, I mean, that started when I was at the church, and it lasted through a few years when I was in Boston.
Oh, that goes up into the early 70s then. But what I was thinking of is that you get involved and promote and create video art. You're a part of that movement, too. You're giving grants to Nam June Paik, I guess, and Charlotte.
No, but also through John Brockman.
Yeah. Who, if you want to look up John Brockman now, go to edge.com, or maybe it's The Edge, his website.
Edge.
Edge.com.
Or anything, Brockman.
Brockman, he shows up everywhere.
Yeah. We decided to do some video things. We were working on a print and media thing called Real Time. Right, it's a publication. I think there were two or three of them.
Yeah, I have copies of them.
Yeah, okay. Now, at that was just the time that Sony put out the first half-inch black and white Portapak deck. The camera was separate, but it was, you bought the whole thing. came together, and the first day they were on sale, I think it was C.T. Lee's, Namjoon and I each bought one. In fact, we saw each other there. I knew Namjoon, you know. So that was the start of my video making.
Right, because Harold Channer, let me just interject. Harold Channer, he's interviewed you, I think. Harold Channer, I've done many cable TV shows with him.
Right.
He said that he got the port-a-pack, maybe the third or fourth one, right off the boat, and Namjoon Paik got the first one, I think. So you were there with Namjoon getting the first ones.
Yes.
And what's C.T. Leaves? That's a store?
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
I don't know.
Leaves, L-E-A.
I don't know if it was L-E-E or L-I-U. I can't remember. I think it still exists. I think his son is running it.
Oh, it's a Chinese name.
Yeah.
Or Japanese.
No, Chinese, I think.
I see. C.T. Leaves. Leaves. I see. Okay. So you, that's when Howard.
That's when I interviewed Marshall and Edward.
M. Twiller.
Hall.
Edward
T.
who?
T. Hall.
Yeah, Edward T. Hall. Yeah, Edward Hall.
Yeah. And probably a lot of other people that you knew, and I have those tapes, but I need to get them copied, and it's a very expensive project. People bake them, it's a long time ago, and they're hard to preserve, but I think I have about 22.
You've interviewed McLuhan. You got McLuhan on video.
I believe so.
Would that have been at the... At Fordham, when he was there from 67 to 68, that period?
It could have been, or it was in Toronto.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Edward T. Hall, who did the Silent Language in the Silent Language in some other book. This is his main ones. But he was a longtime colleague of McLuhan's.
He was. He lived in New Mexico, which is where I interviewed him.
Right, and his letters, which I have copies of, are fantastic. The McLuhan-Hall dialogue is really important. What'd you say?
He was one of the, he and Sapir, right?
Yes.
And those linguistics guys who were involved in the Monterey Language Lab during the Second World War.
Yeah, Worf and Sapir.
Yeah, Worf and Sapir, right.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is reviewing...
Hall came out of that, right?
Hall, yes, I think so.
Yes, he did.
He certainly developed it.
Yeah.
The
Hidden Dimension.
The Hidden Dimension, right. Now, what... The confluence here, which is interesting to me, of the synchronicity of people in your life, is the incredible role of Paul Lee. He was one of the students, I guess he was, that took LSD in Tim Leary's Harvard days, right?
Yeah, the theology students. Yeah.
Yes. And then he connects you, we haven't got into it yet, but he gets you connected to MIT.
Well, first to Brandeis.
To Brandeis, where you put on
He was the Protestant chapel at Brandeis.
Right, and he gives you a platform to do your ESCO projects. And then that connects, when he goes up to MIT, that connects you with him up with the MIT scene. But did you know, I looked up Paul Lee. You were wondering in the Bancroft interview, you lost touch with him. Well, it's very interesting.
I'm in touch with him now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's back in 96 when you're saying that. Well, what he did, which is interesting, he got involved with Ted Carpenter. One of the things he did was with Ted Carpenter, and he edited the amazing work that Carpenter did after he left McLuhan, called Patterns That Connect, on the great anthropologist.
I'm not sure you're right about that.
No, I'm looking at Paul Lee's resume right here on the internet.
Yeah. And do you see that he was an assistant to Paul Tillich?
Yes, that's at the beginning of the resume.
Okay,
yes.
So it's the same Paulie. Okay.
The point is that at Fordham, Carpenter and McLuhan and maybe Ed Hall was there, and Harley Parker.
No, I don't think so. Harley was definitely there.
And Ted Carpenter, maybe not Ed Hall, but he would drop in at when he was in New York. But the thing is that Paul Lee gets hooked in with Ted Carpenter, who's coming out of the McLuhan world. And when Carpenter loses interest in what McLuhan was doing and goes back to being an anthropologist, he finds the archive of Carl Schuster. I think that's what his name was. I have the book somewhere. And they create like 12 huge volumes of the whole archive that Schuster had collected. And that takes a long time to get produced. And it's funded by Ted Carpenter's wife, Adelaide
Demoneal.
And but then they made a small version of it, you know, a hardcover, one edition, one semi-big book, and that was put out by a company called Abrams, and Paul Lee edited it, which is incredible, the synchronicity that you have Ted Carpenter. That means that Paul would be very involved with Ted, and that's the post-McLuhan Ted Carpenter, and Paul Lee is very involved with you, and you knew Ted Carpenter when he showed you the Carlos Castaneda. Well, no, he objected to you having the Carlos Castaneda manuscript, right?
Well, I didn't have it. I just had read it.
Right, right. But this is all in this period, 66, 67, 68, when Steve is finding, unless they don't find that place till 70, the Lama Foundation place. But
I'm sure you can find it on the Internet.
Right. Now, so Paul Lee, he then, after you form Intermedium Boston, somewhere in there, he gets you teaching at Santa Cruz. Now, can you place the timing of Santa Cruz? Is that 68, 69?
No, Santa Cruz isn't until the 70s.
Oh, okay.
After Intermediate Systems is founded.
Founded.
Can you hold on just a second?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, so let's. I think we've covered the LC conference, the balloons, Steve and Barbara looking for the place, and then Paul Lee. Is it Paul Lee who introduces you to Andre Rudy?
Yes.
Yeah, now that's a big connection in your career or life or journey, right? Let's go into that, because that leads to Intermediate Systems.
Okay.
Is it George Litwin?
Yes.
What is Paul? Paul knows somebody up there and takes you to a party and you meet Andre Rudy. I'm just trying to prompt your memory here.
No. You don't have to prompt that. I know the story.
Okay.
Paul Lee invites me to Paul and Charlene, his wife, to stay with them. I'm up in Boston. I don't remember exactly what it was, whether it had to do with the MIT performance or something else. Anyway, I've been in Boston, and I arrived there, and Paul says, I completely forgot that we had to go to a party for the guy who's the head of the media at Harvard.
McClelland?
No.
Not Litwin.
Psychology. No. What's the museum in Boston with the woman's name?
ICA? Not the one you were just talking about.
No. It's somebody's name. It's a classic museum. And Robert Bob, I can't think of his last name, was her grandson. Anyway, I'll come to it. But he was having a big party, and they had to go in formal dress, and I wasn't invited. But he had arranged for me to spend the evening with a guy named Andre Rudy, who was a friend of his and who I would really get along with. And Andre lived in Cambridge. And, yes, I went over there, and it was very copacetic. And it was a big evening, because that's how I met Sarah.
At that evening?
Or that evening, yes. Well, maybe not that evening. Maybe the next time I saw him.
At Andre Rudy's place?
Yes.
So you didn't go to the party. You went to Rudy's place.
Yes.
Yeah. And what was his importance? What was his expertise?
He was at the B school, business school, as a student. He wasn't really a student. He had written his thesis, and he was writing case histories. But he was a very hip guy.
Did you smoke up that first night you met him?
We certainly did. He had a very hip pad, as we used to call them, right?
Yeah.
But eventually we went to see a girlfriend of his who lived across town, and she had a roommate. The roommate was Sally.
Sally Shaw.
Yes.
And that was a fateful meeting personally for you.
Yes, it certainly was. It was a very weird night.
And you'd be 40 at that point, and she'd be 21 or 22, right?
Yeah.
But follow, Rudy leads you to McClellan? Is that what happens, David McClellan?
No, Rudy leads me to George Litman, and George Litman leads me to McClellan.
Just a digression. You know Ed Rosenfeld's book, Networking, Networks?
Yes.
You know that book?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I came out in the 90s, I think, and I have a copy.
I have a copy.
Yeah, in my mind, if you have it right there, isn't George Litman one of the people he interviews?
Maybe.
I remember that name.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
That was just a side thing.
I doubt it. There was you mean Jerry Litvin?
Yeah. Oh, it's Litvin, isn't it? Right.
Yes, Litvin.
Yes, and we're talking George Litwin.
That's right.
All right, that's what I was thinking. So Litwin is a character who helps you but then becomes a problem later. He sends all the money. But go into a bit of how this leads to Intermedia. The business department wants to use multimedia.
No, they don't. McClellan, I have a joint appointment as a fellow in the School of Education and the Business School. I hear a lot of hiss all of a sudden. Do you hear it?
No, not on my end. Do you hear it, Scott?
It just stopped.
Okay.
No.
Now I hear it.
Yeah.
I hear that, but it stopped. Okay, I think it's okay.
Anyway, so I have this joint appointment, and I'm supposed to work in multimedia, and McClellan is very interested in creating moods, and so we put together equipment and a room, and he brings his students, and we use certain colors and certain subjects, like flowers, or to evoke certain moods, right? And
yeah, this is like simple McLuhanism.
the
medium is the massage.
Yeah, but it comes out of the work of people like Murray and McClellan on motivation theory.
You mean Henry Murray?
No.
Who did the secret? I think he's the guy who did the secret LSD test. He was the other Leary at Harvard.
No. Murray, the social psychologist, early on, they put together what are called the TATs, the thematic attention tests.
Yeah.
And there were games, but basically, you know, there are three motivations: achievement, affiliation, and power. NH, NPOW, and NF. There are people who have different components of this. And, of course, the achievement motivation is the most desirable one, according to McLuhan. He was a Quaker, a pacifist.
You said McLuhan. You mean McClellan.
I mean McClellan, right.
Quaker pacifist, right.
And he took it very badly when he was accused of teaching people in the third world entrepreneurial tactics with motivation psychology. And he, you know, he was trying to help people. He's dead now. He moved to where you are.
To Hawaii?
Yes. Remarried after his wife died. Passed on. Yep.
So, he was accused of creating, favoring capitalism, I think.
Yes, exactly.
The achievement would be too individualistic or something. Yeah. Right?
Well, it was creating entrepreneurs. Basically, because it was a business model, and actually, he was the founder of McBurr, M-C-B-E-R, with the guy whose name started with B-E-R, which was the training, for businesses and corporations using the achievement motivation models.
So McClellan inspired that with his book, The Achieving Society, or The Achieving Something. That was the name of the book.
The Achieving Society, right. And that was only one of his books, but that was, yes.
So McClellan, now at the point you're with him, he wants to create climate? Is that what you're saying? Moods in classroom? This is McClellan?
Yeah, that's what we were supposed to do, is mood climates. and we did. And it was very interesting.
But it was done with...
We worked with him in schools, because one of the things about achievement motivation was also in education and work with teachers and children. So.
But this is done with slides? Describe
yes,
a bit.
Slides, some film, but mostly slides, yes, and sound.
Okay, so what are you measuring when you create these environments? Are they being taught a course?
I'm not a measurer.
What were those three things you said? Amph, nymph, and puff. The three kinds of behavior.
Yes. Achievement, affiliation, and power.
And then you made the code of that.
NF, NH, and POW.
M-POW, E-M-P-O-W?
N.
Ned. N is in Ned.
Yeah, N used as a kind of a code. It was N stood for a word, but I can't remember what.
M is in Michael.
No, N.
Okay.
No.
All right. N POW.
Yes.
And what were the first two?
N F.
And achieve was. Something else.
M-H.
M-H.
N. N.
N. N-H.
N-H. N-H. N-P-O-W. N-F.
I got you. Okay. N-F. N-H. N-P-O-W. Now, in the classroom, are the kids being taught business data while the environment is around them?
No, we're talking about classroom climates. In other words, what kind of climate does a teacher and a school provide is oriented towards the achievement of the students. For instance, in the business, let's say you have an insurance company and they have all these little cubicles for people, right?
Yeah.
How does that measure against an open structure environment?
Non-cubicle.
Yeah. I mean, that's maybe that the achievement is much greater. The production may be greater, even though the privacy is eliminated. But, you know, there are all these, I mean, this is, these are theories.
Yeah.
And they're academic environments that we're involved in. But on the other hand, we're trying to create a business, because that's through Litwin, but we don't have capital, so eventually I introduced George to Reuben Gorowitz, or the artist accountant, and Reuben introduces us to people in the investment world, and we go public. But you see, it's not through the business people who told me we're going to have this company and we're going to do the business and you're not going to have to worry about any of that. You're going to take care of the art and the technology, right?
Right.
Michael. But it turns out that they're really psychologists. They're not really business people. And, you know, I wind up coming up with the money connection.
Yes.
Strangely. But it all, yeah, like you say, it goes bad. George is a big spender. He drives a Corvette. He lives so high off the hog, on the hog. He still is, by the way, to this day.
Is he still teaching, or is he retired from that?
No, he's basically into, you know, training and writing motivational stuff for corporations.
Yeah, that's early versions of Werner Erhard's Forum, Est and
well,
Forum.
Well, not really. Werner Erhard was like, into personal growth.
But then his successors formed something called Forum, and they started doing it to corporations.
I know all about it.
You know about that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But then they're still working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know people who are still involved.
The very room I'm staying in Maui is sublet from one of the geniuses of the Forum movement.
He did
very well.
A lot of them did very well.
Yeah. Okay, so what? George Litwin. What'd you say?
No, I said they did better than L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah. So George Litwin, because he's president of the company, you brought in the money, and he gets to spend it. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, I didn't really bring in the money. I just made the introductions, you know. That's the first time I've ever said that, because I never even thought of it that way. But it happens to be that way.
So George.